Howdy, everybody, and welcome to another BP Movie Journal, the show I do where I talk about the stuff that I've seen since the last time I did one of these. That's right, it's me, David, flying solo again. Tyler will be back on the journal in a couple of weeks. No, I don't think I'll do a journal next week, so it'll just be the two of us in 2 weeks. But it's been a while since I did one of these, so I have some catching up to do. So let's jump right into it. Starting with, I watched a movie directed by Henry King, 1950's The Gunfighter, starring Gregory Peck. It's a Western, as you might imagine. It was actually, those who remember might remember that, Julie talked about it on the TCM Classic Film Festival wrap-up. I did not see it at the fest, but I did watch it on Blu-ray. I guess it kind of got me thinking about, I feel like I was in film school, I was taught, and we read about the idea of the revisionist Western kind of starting in like the 60s with like the Wild Bunch and stuff like that. But this is 1950, and, this is an entire movie about how being the baddest, fastest gun in the West is an incredibly lonely, punishing, existentially fraught and painful position to be in. Gregory Peck plays a guy who has made that name for himself and has now blown back into the town where some of his old cohorts live to try and make amends, have a conversation. We don't know what exactly his plans are because he doesn't get very far before he's recognized and people already start challenging him, and it's a Western, has a couple of shootouts, or at least, you know, some gunplay, mostly at the beginning and at the end, but most of the middle section of the movie is just this guy sort of talking to the people around him about how his life sucks and he made the wrong decisions, and he's trying to put things as right as he can before he is inevitably like gunned down by someone trying to make a name for themselves as the fastest gun in the West. So kind of the very, very sad version of the first entry in the Ballad of Buster Scruggs. After that, I went to movie theater, because that's the way to see this movie. I went to the movie theater to see Joseph Kosinski's Top Gun Maverick. Now, I will say that I'm not counting it, because I don't count every rewatch as an entry in the movie journal, but I did rewatch Top Gun, the first one, the night before, in preparation for this. It's not very good. Top Gun is not very good, and Top Gun Maverick is so much better, but not the stuff that, like, it's still not I'm trying to think how to say this. Basically, my one sentence review is that Top Gun Maverick, every time anyone gets in a plane and gets up in the air, the movie's amazing, and it just doesn't let the movie go too long in between without that stuff happening. So this is like, it doesn't let you get bored, really. So I don't want to say that this is like, wow, this is like the, you know, the Logan of Top Gun movies. Like, this really like investigates the, gets inside the psyche of Maverick. No, we see he's pretty much the same guy he was at the end of Top Gun, and has lived that way for 30 something years. And the movie's just an excuse to get him back up into the air. And Joseph Kosinski shoots these amazing flying sequences that are not fakey, you know, they're not like pre-visualization, they're all real fighter jets, as Tom Cruise told us before the movie in a pre-recorded statement. Real fighter jets flying around, real reactions. And I think it definitely rivals Ambulance for best American action movie of 2022 so far. I probably overall liked Ambulance more because it has even fewer boring parts, whereas Top Gun Maverick has like a whole plot line with Jennifer Connelly. Though this is the one this is the one benefit to my having rewatched Top Gun the night before, is that like I knew they weren't bringing back Kelly McGillis as Charlie from Top Gun, but I did recognize, because I watched it the night before, I did recognize like, oh, Jennifer Connelly's character isn't some new made up love interest. This is actually the Admiral's daughter that Goose references in the first movie. But this, none of that is the reason to see it. The reason to see it is to be, as I was, so tense that I'm literally not sitting in my chair. I was kind of like a board, like perpendicular from the edge in the back of the chair for most of the last like 40 minutes of the movie. Next up, I watched a documentary called The Newspaper Man. The Newspaperman. The Life and Times of Ben Bradlee. This is a documentary about Ben Bradlee, the former editor of the Washington Post. Has the benefit of actually being narrated by him, because of like notes that he took for an autobiography or memoir. I'm not sure if that ever came out. But this is, you know, pretty standard, like, made for HBO documentary type of stuff. It's not groundbreaking cinema. It's mostly just an overview. You know, it's a filmed magazine article. I found it interesting and somewhat informative, but I kind of feel like between All the President's Men and The Post, I kind of feel like I already had a pretty good idea of Ben Bradlee. Not a whole lot of revelations, but you know what was revelatory is Terrence Davies' Benediction. I'm at a loss here because I'm kind of stuck for what to say about Terrence Davies, whose style as a filmmaker and his interests are so classical. You know, this is a I just talked about like a standard template for a movie with The Newspaperman. Terrence Davies made, this is a movie that is a biopic of a British poet from the early and mid 20th century named Siegfried Sassoon. And again, like, you could see this is very like well appointed and a handsome movie, and there's so many ways I could describe this movie that make it sound like standard like Sony Pictures Classics like period costume drama. But his Terrence Davies movies are so imbued in up to the brim, almost overflowing with emotion, even though the characters are often not, you know, there's not a lot of like Sturm und Drang at all or anything like that. There's just such loving attention paid to every detail, in a very classical sense of framing and blocking, but also production design and costume design, and you've got a great script and great actors. There's something to be said for the way that Terrence Davies in general, Benediction in particular, argues that, you know, because maybe I'm even learning this lesson myself, because I've said, like, I think, you know, last year or 2 years ago or whatever, I said that like the movie Zola like sort of showed how movies like need to adapt to stay relevant. I'm not sure how relevant Benediction is outside of like cinephile circles, but it does make an argument that like there is still a great deal of beauty that can be wrung from traditional like classicist filmmaking made with expertise and a great deal of brilliant creativity and care. It's an incredibly moving movie. I haven't gotten into the details about how it goes sort of back and forth in many ways between young Siegfried Sassoon's life and his older life. They're full of love, but also very full of pain. There's he came back from the First World War, but also is a gay man, and he's also an like intellectual or whatever, and all of these. He's basically like a member with his like PTSD makes him. The movie doesn't call it PTSD, but like he's clearly like the war plays a big part in his psyche, and so you've got this movie about him like belonging to certain, I don't know, identities or groups or whatever that are all like cloistered in their own way. He can't really talk about his war experience, but he also can't really talk about his sexuality outside of his immediate circle, and his interests in art and literature and stuff make him not as mainstream. It's just a very sad story about a man like belonging to different groups and not and none of them really giving him the sense of community or what have you that that groups are supposed to. Speaking of gay men, I suppose, weird transition, but that's what Fire Island is about. Andrew Wan is a director that I have definitely sung the praises of before, starting with his debut feature Spa Night and continuing with 2020's beautiful and quiet but lovingly observed movie Driveways. Now he's made his sort of not major, it's a Searchlight picture, direct to Hulu type of thing, but his like highest profile movie yet, Fire Island, which is I didn't know this until after the fact because I'm not a Jane Austen guy, but is an adaptation of Pride and Prejudice set on Fire Island, which once I know that, I realized like, oh yeah, I saw the Pride and Prejudice movie with Keira Knightley, so I see the comparisons, but it's beautifully photographed by Felipe Vara del Rey is the cinematographer, and it's interesting to compare it to Andron's previous work because it has, you know, Driveways took place in sort of an ex-urban part of America, and here you've got this like island escape where there are, you know, woods and beaches and walkways, and so you've got this like proximity to nature that you had in Driveways. You've also got gay men like you had in Spa Night, but Spa Night is about a mostly closeted man. Fire Island is a place where all of these men who are already out in their normal lives anyway, they start the movie talking about how we don't have to see another straight person for an entire week. And that's true, by the way. There are no straight characters in the movie. So I guess the idea of taking like modern urban gay life into a more a less urban setting is an interesting dynamic. I mean, it's not obviously not like it's interesting dynamic for the movies we tend to see about gay men in real life. There are gay men all over the place, and gay men do go to Fire Island. I've known Fire Island as a reference for most of my life. For that reason, and so there's a, I guess the sense of community in place really comes across in the movie. The cast is also very charming. The movie is often very funny, and the the romance, the various romances hit. I'm like rooting for the characters. Moving on to 1970s incredibly poor taste movie, The Other Side of Madness, directed by Frank Howard. This is a basically, it has some documentary footage, but it is basically a reenactment of the Tate LaBianca murders, the Helter Skelter Charlie Manson murders, and in the in the days leading up to the events leading up to them, and it also features a song by Charles Manson. And like I said, this is 1970. This is like when this stuff was all real fresh. So again, very much in poor taste. That said, not made without skill. This is not a purely schlock exercise. There, Frank Howard, who's like never made anything else, as far as I can tell. Like he knows how to sustain interest without dialogue over a long period of time. There's also like some almost impressionistic like cutting between like the documentary footage and like courtroom testimony and stuff, and weaving these things together to give a sense. I don't know if it's an accurate sense. He's a little bit too into it, but to give a sense of the Spahn Ranch and the days leading up to this. And then the murder scenes themselves, again, horrifying and really ghoulish that he did this so soon after it happened, and envisioned these murders as thoroughly as he did, but also like not poorly directed. I'm so like hesitant to say nice things about this this movie, but it definitely was not it was way more watchable than I thought it would be, but in a horrifying way. All right, next up, I guess it's not really a documentary. I guess it's more of a concert film in the sense that it's like a stage performance. It's called Notes from the Field. The director's name is Christy Zaya or Zia, and it is a one-woman play. It's the great Anna Deavere Smith stars, and she is, I guess it's a documentary play is the terminology I've heard for this sort of thing before, where all of the, it's a series of monologues, but all those monologues are taken from actual like interviews or again court testimony or things like that, and so she's playing all these different people along the story of the, I'm not sure how to wrap it all up, but from police brutality victims and those who have like caught police brutality on camera, to the prison system, to just the it seems to be a movie in which she is, even though she's not only playing black men, it is a movie about the all the different directions in America from which pressure is put on black men, and it seems to be trying to force them into a very narrow set of options, and the outcome often feels predetermined. It's the thing is, the movie I think or the piece I guess is seems kind of like pessimistic and fatalistic, but it has this kind of like obligatory like lightweight uplift near the end that I kind of rolled my eyes at. But as a showcase for Anna Deavere Smith, you can't go wrong, and who wouldn't want a 90-minute showcase for the great Anna Deavere Smith? Sorry, I had to take a water break there. It's just me talking today. So after Notes from the Field, I watched another, I guess, sort of documentary, Symbiopsycho Taxiplasm Take One. I've been wanting to see this for a long time. And if you don't know the movie, it's the director William Greaves. The premise is that he's shooting a scene. I don't know. It's supposed to, I've heard it described as it's supposed to be a screen test. I don't really. He's shooting a scene, an argument between a couple, but he's also shooting the crew making the scene. We're seeing the process of it being made, but then we're also getting offset, like in the production office or downtime, like conversations about the movie, both the movie that he's shooting in the park, but also the movie that we're watching, without him in it. So it's a movie about the making of, but it's not about the making of a movie. It's about the making of a scene, which only exists to make this movie about the making of the scene. So it's a movie about itself, I guess. And what I'll say is, if that sounds like dense to you, don't worry. The movie is a lot of fun, actually. There's also a lot of stuff that doesn't. I mean, I think they're talking about things that are important, but a lot of the terminology chafes today. With they're talking the scene between the couple, often the woman, her dig at her husband, or yeah, I think they're supposed to be married, is to question his sexuality. And I think, and this comes up in the conversation, that talking about those kind of like deep-seated fears in straight men, and the way that someone who knows a man well enough can like push his buttons by speaking to those fears is very very interesting. But there's also a lot of F slur that you kind of have to take with a grain of salt, I think. It feels weird to say that a movie's fun that has that so much of that language, but it really is, because William Greaves himself, this is what I'm saying, he doesn't seem like, it seems like a serious like high concept project, but whenever he's on camera, he seems to be like kind of like having a good time and just like really into seeing where this goes, and clearly was fine with leaving in a lot of conversations among the crew that are questioning him, not to his face, like behind his back, questioning him. Yeah, I guess I've often said, not an original quote, I've often quoted the quote that every film is a documentary of its own making, and Symbiopsycho Taxiplasm Take One is literally that. Okay. Moving on to a new Greek film, debut film from director Christos Niko, who had worked previously under Yorgos Lanthimos. His debut film was called Apples, and it takes place in modern Greece, but in this world there's this unexplained disease or something going around, and that causes people to have sudden amnesia, and permanent amnesia. And so the main character is a man to whom this happens, and then he, you know, goes to the hospital. No one comes to claim him, so we get the impression he must be a very solitary person. And then he starts. He enrolls in this sort of experimental treatment for the amnesia, and through that he meets a woman who is also in the same boat that he's in. I think Christos Niko and the main actor, whose name I think is Aris Servitalis, really do a good job of getting at the sadness. It feels like, given how much of it is in the sort of Yorgos Lanthimos style, it feels like there's a risk of it, of the movie being sad in that sort of like self-consciously hip Riley Stearns type of way, that tends to irk me. And there is some of that where it's like a little too pleased with itself, but I actually buy that this guy's life, even probably even before, but especially like just the idea of not knowing who you are, is not treated as just a high concept premise for the movie. It's psychologically real and truly sad. So I like that stuff about it, but there is, I think, still too much like post-Lanthimos like deadpan cutesiness. That's not the right word, but that's how I think of it. As it, the movie's, oh, you think you're cute, huh? Apples. The movie's even called Apples, which is a cute name. All right, next movie I'm not going to talk much about at all, because Tyler talked about it a while ago, like a year ago, I don't know, the Movie Journal. A 1958 monster movie directed by Richard E. Cunha called Giant from the Unknown. It's a about a couple of scientists in rural who find themselves in rural America, as most of these movies usually are about, and then a lightning strike brings to life the corpse of a Spanish conquistador who then goes around terrorizing people. But also that doesn't happen to like halfway through the movie. The movie, like a lot of these B horror movies from the period, it's actually like really talky, and it's like 77 minutes or whatever, feels a lot longer. There's a part, there's like the young scientist and the older scientist, and the older scientist has a daughter who conveniently is very pretty and also is about the same age as the younger scientist. So I wonder what's going to happen there. Anyway, the two scientists are going off to look for whatever the fuck they're looking for, and they're like, you stay behind and like tend to the campsite or whatever, lady. And there's a shot of the woman. She's got like hands on her hips and shaking her head as they're walking off, and it holds forever. Like, he's just trying to get to that 77 minute runtime or whatever. Forever she's like shaking her head, and then finally she goes, men have all the fun. it's so awkward and telegraphed and drawn out, and a lot of the movie just seems, a lot of the movie is like that, just kind of like boring. But at least I picked out something that was like weirdly like funny in an unintentional way. Most of the movie isn't that. Most of the movie is just boring.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable.
All right, moving on to a movie that was a huge surprise to me and shouldn't have been. But I think there's... Okay, here's what happens with these direct-to-Netflix movies. Every time one comes out, especially if it has a big star or is by a big director, you see the same like conversation on film Twitter about like, can you believe there's a whole new like Richard Linklater movie or whatever coming out in less than a week and no one is talking about it? But the thing is, everyone who would want to know about it is talking about it. So whatever Netflix is doing, it weirdly, it doesn't work in the way that I would like, because I would like people other than already committed Richard Linklater fans to know about a new Richard Linklater movie. The movie I'm talking about isn't a Richard Linklater movie. I'll get to it in a second. But I guess what I'm saying is people keep calling this out as if it's like a fuck up on Netflix's part. Like, how are they not promoting this movie? But then when it comes out, all the people who want to see it will see it. So it works for Netflix to do things this way. I don't love it because it makes movies more of a niche, you know, a big movie should be visible to more people than just the people it would already appeal to based on its like keywords and logline or whatever. So that brings me to the movie that I'm talking about that I wish I had known more about beforehand, because one thing that did get lost is that Hustle, I knew, was the new, like, semi-serious Adam Sandler basketball movie. I didn't know until I saw it that it was directed by Jeremiah Zagar, who made We the Animals a few years ago, which I loved. And I wish I'd been more excited beforehand to see this, because here's the thing. It's really good. Hustle is... In a way, if it's a very different movie from Benediction, but it kind of goes to the type of thing that I was talking about, where it's just like, it's the filmmaking is still very Jeremiah Zagar. There's a lot of the camera kind of floats, and the lighting is often it feels intentionally like as if the I know it's all digital, but it kind of looks like it's been like pushed in post-production, where things that are a little like darks are like the blacks are a little chunkier than they would be in a quote unquote like Hollywood like professional production. So it has that kind of like independent feel to it, even though it's clearly not an independent movie. A Netflix movie is not an independent movie. But what I'm saying is it's all in service of a pretty standard inspirational sports movie. Adam Sandler plays a former athlete who's now a pro scout who discovers this like completely unknown out of left field talent, and nobody believes him, and he like makes it his goal to, because it was like, you know, we would have known, we know, you know, the scouts know about future NBA players when they're in seventh grade or whatever. We would know. And so it becomes his like mission to get this guy into the NBA. It has a lot of NBA people playing themselves or playing characters who are like themselves. I don't really have anything to say about that because I don't follow basketball, so I don't know who any of these people are. But it's just inspirational sports stuff. It's great. Adam Sandler is great. Like at what he does, he's very charming. He's very root forable, which, you know, various directors have used to different ends. But yeah, definitely recommend Hustle. All right, next up, this is a double feature I saw at the Arrow of they're doing a whole month long Samuel L. Jackson retrospective, and so they actually programmed on a 35mm film a Casey Lemons double feature, two films by Casey Lemons that star Samuel L. Jackson. The first is Eve's Bayou, which is a movie that I have literally for 25 years been like meaning to get to, and it was kind of like, oh, here's an excuse to like go see Eve's Bayou. And yeah, it didn't disappoint. It's a period piece coming of age movie starring a young Journey Smollett as, not to split hairs, a character named Eve, but she is not the titular character. Eve's Bayou is the name of the town, and Journey Smollett's Eve is descended from and named after the woman the town is named after, but it's not technically a titular character. That's not important at all, but I just wanted to make that distinction. You know, I mentioned before one thing I liked about Fire Island is that there are no straight characters. There are no white people in Eve's Bayou or any other race other than black people. It is about a 1960s small black town, or at least a neighborhood in a black neighborhood in a small town in Louisiana, and everything. And I think because there's no one other than black people, the movie doesn't specifically recognize race in any way. And so in some ways you could say this is just a movie about a community, and the way that there are secrets and connections and rivalries and resentments and all these things boiling in any community. You could say that, but also you can point to the very a coincidence that important and remarkable that Samuel Jackson's character is like not just a doctor, he's like the black doctor, you know. So it's in one sense about a community, but it's about a community that has to be, in a way, has to be like there for each other and closely involved in one another's lives, because they have to depend on one another at all times. But mostly, like I said, it's a coming of age story about a girl sort of realizing that the world is a more complex place. I don't want to give too much away because it has some big secrets and some big questions. But it's another movie that's a great sense of community. And then they followed that up with another movie that I had never, this one, unlike Used by You, I had never really meant to see, The Caveman's Valentine. I don't remember it getting good reviews when it came out. But I'm so glad I saw it. I'm so glad I saw it the way I did, you know, on 35 millimeter and on a big screen, because it's essentially the, like, high in the running for strangest film noir I've ever seen. It's about a schizophrenic homeless man played by Samuel Jackson who lives in a cave in a park in New York City, and then a dead body is found outside of his cave. He's not a suspect in the murder or anything. In fact, no one thinks it's a murder at first, but some thinks it's just a guy succumbed to the elements. But because this happens, he gets involved in solving this murder that goes into like the world of like high-priced art and finance, and all the while he is dealing with his paranoid delusions about a man who lives in the Chrysler Building and is pulling the strings and trying to ruin his life. In particular, he's also like dealing with the fact that, you know, he has a grown daughter that is essentially not a part of his life because of what's going on with him. It's such a strange movie. As like detective noir, I would say its plot kind of like, there's a lot of intrigue, and then like it all gets wrapped up and explained in a big like villain speech at the end. It has that sort of like, I guess it's a good mystery if it had been apportioned correctly, but it's really just like kind of awkwardly like, here's how everything happened. So it's not like great noir in that sense, but in the sense of a everyman, who is in this case not an everyman, getting drawn into an underworld, which is in this case has to do with fine art and wealth. It's a pretty fascinating and strange bit of film noir. So that's The Caveman's Valentine. We are moving right along to Sophie Hyde's Good Luck to You, Leo Grand, which is a showcase for two actors, Emma Thompson and Daryl McCormick. She is a retired teacher and a widow who has enlisted the services of a male escort named Leo Grand to spend some time in a hotel room, and they end up having multiple sessions. And the movie is essentially like a four-act play that's mostly just these two characters. It's very well acted. I mean, you can't go wrong with Emma Thompson, but I also think its ambitions are kind of superficial. Like, it's very one way. Like, Leo is a character who, like, I mean, he doesn't, like, have it all figured out, but there's not that much to his character. I think I kept expecting the movie to be more of, like, a back and forth. But it really is just... It's just a story of this woman sort of having a late bloom and realizing, you know, the ways in which she has lived very small up until this point. And I guess that's my other problem. I still think it's very, like... competently made and again wonderfully acted. So like if I had to, you know, if you tried to pin me down, I had to say like more thumbs up than thumbs down, but I have some problems with it, and that's another one, is that it feels like it's too content to, you know, I like movies that figure things out along with the characters. I feel like in this case there's a sense that the movie already is where it wants I forget her name, Nancy is her name. I feel like the movie is already where it wants Nancy to end up, and then it looks upon itself and her approvingly for having gotten there by the end of the movie. And I feel like that's a little small. That's you can do more with art than just you know, lay out a thesis. So I sound like I'm being very critical. There's plenty to recommend the movie. But to move on to a movie that is just, I think, kind of aggressively not for me, and I'm sorry. I saw Dean Fleischer Kemp's Marcel the Shell with Shoes On. I managed to avoid... I mean, I knew of Marcel the Shell with Shoes On when it was like a web series or whatever it was, and I never watched it. It didn't seem like it was for me. Now I've seen the full-length movie version. And yeah, it's not really for me. It's... I love Jenny Slate, and she does get some... she's doing Marcel as of in a very, she's voicing this shell with the sentient shell with shoes, in a very like cute, like little boy type of way. But like, she's saying things that are actually funny and maybe sometimes like challenging the human character, played by, Dean Fleischer Kemp. So there's some funny stuff, but mostly it's just like, it's a pretty standard, like, Marcel is a shell that has been separated from his community, from his family, and he finds a human companion who wants to help him reunite. It's pretty familiar kid movie stuff. It has Jenny Slate's voice, literally and figuratively, going for it, but it's really just not my cup of tea, I guess. Like Spike Lee said about Green Book, wasn't my cup of tea. Okay, back to older movies. I watched 1977's The Ascent, directed by Larissa Shepetko. I feel like I just watched this the other night. My brain is like so fried right now from doing this movie journal on my own. I'm drawing a blank on what to say about it. It's very harrowing, stuff about, Soviet soldiers, I guess, during World War II, a lot of Russian films, a lot of Soviet films particularly, it has a clear agenda. I mean, most movies do, but like, a lot of Soviet films were, you know, if not, were financed by and then had to be approved by the government, so they had to have messaging, I guess, that the government would approve of. And so the movie is definitely like very anti-German, which when you come into World War II, like, yeah, that's not that difficult. Like, I am not, that's not a complaint. I'm not complaining about the movie's clear, like, Russians are good guys and Germans are the bad guys. But I think what's interesting is that the movie is about, like I said, these two soldiers who, once captured by the Germans, they take very different paths in how they react to being captured by the Germans. And it pretty much, those paths pretty much still bring them to the same place. It's a bleak black and white movie. It's a black and white movie, and also takes place in, like, snowy countryside, so it's like it's a very stark monochromatic movie, and I think that is reflected in its view that when you're dealing with bad guys like the Germans, it doesn't matter what you do, they're still out to get you. I feel like I could have said more about that, but I'm fried. And also, it was like peek behind the curtain. I was like, I kind of had like a panic attack that night that I watched The Ascent, so I feel bad that I didn't have more to say about it. I guess I have a bit more to say if you'll let me take a drink real quick. Jesus. I have a bit more to say about Cooper Rafe's Cha-Cha Real Smooth, a movie I was very much looking forward to because his debut feature a couple years ago, Shithouse, really took me by surprise. I thought the name Shithouse was stupid, and I thought it was going to be, you know, it's about this, like, it's this very young writer-director starring in it. It's an indie about a college kid, you know, falling in love with his RA or whatever. And I was like, this seems so navel-gazing, so masturbatory. And then I watched it, and it has way more self-awareness. And also just a fantastically light touch with the filmmaking for someone, usually young directors are so out to like make a voice or like establish a voice in themselves to prove themselves that they kind of like become self-conscious in the direction, and Shithouse felt so natural and so able to exist in a moment to evoke a relationship between characters, moment to moment, a conversation, you know, the way it elucidates the air in between the characters in a lot of ways. Anyway, this isn't even a movie I watched. I watched Shithouse 2 years ago. What I'm saying is, I loved Shithouse, or I really liked it, but maybe pumped up to love because it was such a surprise. So I was really looking forward to Cha-Cha Real Smooth. And I'm not going to say it disappointed, but I will say Cha-Cha Real Smooth is not as good as Shithouse, because I do think it has a little bit of the, like, again, Cooper Rafe wrote and stars in it, and I think he's a little bit, like, nicer to this character in a way that feels like self, I heard he used the word masturbatory, so I have to say something else, self-service, like a gas station. It does seem a little bit like this dude who's supposed to be like awkward and directionless also has plenty of luck with women and is like a natural and like very funny in a lot of situations. It feels like he's kind of puffing himself up a little bit, but the characters being like very naturally conversational and personable is actually a big part of the plot. So I don't want to say that that's just self-congratulatory icing on the cake. It is important, but I didn't find Cha-Cha Real Smooth to be as psychologically engaging as Shithouse. But that sense of moments that are simultaneously indelible and fleeting, I think that is something that carries over that is very present in Cha-Cha Real Smooth. And as often, it's the kind of thing I think that we, I don't know, those of us who are geriatric millennials and older, you know, Gen X and boomers and stuff like that, think of as like, well, that's a mature, like normally, you know, we think youth is wasted on the young, that sort of thing. And like, wow, for a guy who's in his early 20s to be that aware of how fleeting and rare every single moment is not that common. But I also think that, you know, I don't want to say that Chacha Aerosmith is anywhere near in the company of the worst person in the world, but it kind of has that similar, like, yeah, to younger people now, though, they live in a world where, especially if they're paying attention, you know, like, existential threats are always looming, and they seem inevitable. And I think being, you know, the LCD Sound System song where he's talking about, like, I never knew, when he's talking about all the songs that are like, tonight, 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 I never knew so many young people thought about dying. And I wanted to be like, yeah, James Murphy, young people do think about dying because they have to all the time, because the world seems like it could get yanked out from under them at any moment. And so I do think, I don't want to, like, I mean, there's no way to be like, keep a straight face and use phrases like voice of a generation, but I do think that to paraphrase Hannah from episode one of Girls, Cooper Rafe is a voice of his generation. I look forward to seeing what he does, next, especially, I didn't even get to like the biggest, like, special effect, if you will, in Chacha Aerosmith is Dakota Johnson. And in Shit House, he cast Dylan Galula. He has a really great eye for casting people that he will work well with, that play well off of him. And Dakota Johnson is so wonderful in this movie as the, like, I guess for Cooper Rafe, older woman, although she's having the very pointedly not as old as the other moms that he comes into contact with in his job as a bar and bat mitzvah party starter. Now I lost my train of thought, but her, Dakota Johnson's screen presence and allure, I've always liked her, but this might be the best showcase for her pure movie star qualities that I have seen so far. And there's some competition too, because I like a lot of her stuff. All right, last couple, let's blow through them. Last night saw a new British comedy called Brian and Charles, directed by Jim Archer, starring David Earle and Chris Hayward as Brian and Charles. Brian is a small town loner and eccentric who fancies himself an inventor, but is very bad at all of the, like, mechanic and engineering parts of inventing. But then he does sort of accidentally, and maybe with some help from a lightning strike, invent a, like, artificially intelligent robot named Charles. And the movie is about the friendship between this man and this very goofy robot. Yeah, a lot of the stuff is not particularly deep. I think if there's a main reason to watch Brian and Charles, it's for the laughs. David Earle is a good comic persona, and Charles, the robot, you know, if you're going to have a funny robot, you got to have a funny robot voice. And the voice they landed on for Charles is the best thing about the movie, in that it's like, it's a halting, like, robot voice, kind of like you think of, like, you associate with, like, Stephen Hawking or whatever, but it's also kind of like posh. But also he's, as he gets older, he's kind of like he goes from being like Brian's pet to being like Brian's child, and then like he becomes like a petulant, like, teenager or whatever. And so he's doing things like, you know, headstrong teenager things of like trying to push the boundaries of what Brian will get him, let him get away with in this like self-centered teenage way, but also he sounds like an aristocratic robot at the same time. That's definitely the best source of comedy in the movie. I don't know. Emotionally, there's like a romance with Brian and another woman, and then there's like a bully in town, and it all seems kind of like formulaic. And then final movie I watched just last night, a documentary from 2017 called Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman. And it is it was made for the Discovery Channel. It's a sort of triptych, as the title suggests, about ranchers, farmers, and fishermen who are changing the way that they do their jobs with an eye toward things like sustainability, basically. And often it's by not looking forward to like what are new things we can do. It's looking past. It's looking back. It's saying like how were these jobs done before they were so mechanized and so massively commercial? How can we ranch, farm, and fish in ways that suit our needs and the country and society's needs, and not plunder and destroy the land. Again, like almost kind of like going back to that Newspaperman documentary, the Ben Bradley documentary. Feels very made for TV and very like I'm here to get a point across, not to like make a startling revelatory cathartic cinema. And so I feel like I learned a lot. I know what no-till farming is now. I know about the red snapper derbies that used to exist that were well-intentioned, but had the a more deleterious effect on the red snapper population than they were supposed to, where they were supposed to preserve. I know some things now that I didn't know before, and I guess that's something you can say for Ranger, Farmer, Fisherman.